From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. California Senator Kamala Harris has been making waves on the national scene, especially since her breakout performance at the first Democratic presidential candidate debate. Harris took on frontrunner Joe Biden with a fierce confidence that cleaved away many percentage points in his lead. Now that she's snagged the number three spot in the race, her brief record as senator, and more importantly, her tenure as California's attorney general, is under greater scrutiny. The adept politician has claimed in particular that she took on the nation's biggest banks during the foreclosure crisis and, quote, passed the strongest anti-foreclosure law in the U.S. But journalist David Dayan, writing in The Intercept, says in truth what Harris won was quite different from what she says. David Dayan is the executive editor at The American Prospect. His first book is called Chain of Title, and it's about three ordinary Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. It was released in May 2016. David's been a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about what it is that Harris says she did as attorney general. And we'll put the quote up on the screen for our TV audience. In her speech, this was her speech where she announced her presidential bid. She said, for the people meant fighting for middle class families who had been defrauded by banks and were losing their homes by the millions in the Great Recession. And I'll tell you, sitting across the table from the big banks, I witnessed the arrogance of power, wealthy bankers accusing innocent homeowners of fault as if Wall Street's mess was of the people's making. So we went after the five biggest bank in the U.S. We won $20 billion down together. We passed the strongest anti-foreclosure law in the U.S. We did that together. What is wrong with what she says?
Well, the foreclosure crisis and the associated fraud that came up around it really is the largest consumer fraud in American history. And it certainly wasn't treated in any sense by the law enforcement apparatus of this country as the serious set of crimes that it in fact was. We're talking in the end about settlements. No banker or anyone really associated with this, save for one individual who was lower level, went to prison for any of this conduct, which involved effectively stealing homes. I mean, we're talking about material that was submitted to courts and county offices across the country that was phony and that was used to take people out of their homes. It was used as evidence in foreclosure cases. And none of that was given really a just bit of accountability. And it was all put into these settlements with these top line numbers that really don't bear a whole lot of resemblance to what the reality was for homeowners in the aftermath. And I can go into more detail on that if you like.
So how important was California as an epicenter of this crisis nationwide? If California was one of the main states this happened, as Attorney General, Kamala Harris was the top enforcer of the law.
Yeah, California was one of the four so-called sand states, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. These were the hardest hit states. Half of all subprime loans occurred in those four states. And so obviously they had an obvious importance to the foreclosure crisis and this aftermath of Wall Street industrially producing these fake documents in these foreclosure cases. But Harris was an attorney general when the 50-state investigation began. She didn't really talk about it very much for several months as it was underway. And she only sort of reluctantly broke with this 50-state negotiation, which was negotiating pretty immediately on a settlement, not a fulsome investigation of everything that went wrong and who was responsible. Harris only broke with that after a grassroots movement bombarded the attorney general's office with phone calls for several days. And Gavin Newsom, who is now the governor of California, but at the time was lieutenant governor and really Kamala Harris's main rival in California politics. He sided with the protesters, saying that we should not give this toothless settlement away to the big banks. And only then did Harris really speak up and decide to break with these talks, only to go back to them several months later. When she left the talks, the numbers being floated around at the top line, which again aren't really true, and I can get into that, the top line numbers being floated around when Kamala left in September of 2011 were $20 million. What they ended up settling on in February of 2012 was $25 million. This really isn't like this tremendous amount of extra accountability when you're talking about these sums of money, not real accountability. It doesn't come out of the banker's pocket, doesn't come out of their bonus, and it has nothing to do with criminal charges being placed on the banks. And it's not that much more money to begin with, and really that money wasn't really used in the way that it was promised to during that settlement.
So she said that we won $20 billion altogether.
Right. Did I say million?
Yes. Okay. So
the numbers are billions. The numbers are billions, but let's talk about that $20 billion.
Right.
So what she's talking about there is the gross alleged value of mortgage reductions for California homeowners. That was only one part of the settlement, but that's the part that she focuses on. So let's break that number down. About $9 billion of that $20 billion number is short sales. And what that means is that someone sells their home for less than they actually owe on the mortgage, and the bank says, okay, you're allowed to do that. We're not gonna go after you for the balance of the mortgage. Now, that might be helpful in terms of somebody's credit score, but it results in them losing their home. They are forced to sell it. And by the way, under California law, you're not allowed as a bank to go after some balance of mortgage, extra mortgage that you don't pick up in a sale. It's actually called California's called a non-recourse state. So the dollar value in real terms of forgiving the balance on a mortgage loan is $0. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't trust me. The IRS actually said in a letter to Barbara Boxer that had no material value. Forgiving the portion of a loan in a non-recourse state like California has zero value whatsoever. Another $4 or $5 billion of that number relates to forgiveness of second loans, like junior liens. These are home equity lines of credit or a second mortgage that somebody takes out that were completely delinquent. They were called almost dead, basically dead. These loans that were never going to be collected in the first place, but banks got credit for forgiving them. They only got a portion of that credit, but Kamala Harris is counting the entire number of the amount that they forgave on those loans. So if you look at the real numbers, $14 billion out of the $20 billion that she's counting, 70% are either short sales where someone loses their home or worthless second mortgage loans that were forgiven that were never going to be collected anyway. It's just phony math is what she's talking about.
And so she is making this claim about, you know, fighting for the middle class, because of course that's what one does when one runs for president. But I'm wondering if you feel that she is also responding to this palpable leftward shift within the Democratic Party's base. She and others, realize that they need to start appearing like champions of ordinary Americans.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the base wanted, in this case, accountability for the injustices that were done by big banks during the foreclosure crisis. But to call what happened in that crisis a triumph, to say that I got a relatively better settlement than other states, which, by the way, I mean, as bad as the settlement is, Harris is relatively could be seen as better than other states. I don't think that is I think that's sort of cold comfort. But you know, so to say that this was a triumph, to equate like a toothless settlement with a triumphant penalty for criminal fraud, I'm worried about what that does in the future, because it really sets a baseline and says what Kamala Harris did equals punishment in this context. And what that does is it ensures that we're going to have more crimes like this in the future. We're not going to dismantle a system of justice that's two-tiered, where one group of people get, one set of rules and justice and accountability, and another set of people get something far different. We're never going to fix that if we're just going to paper over these glaring inadequacies in our very recent past. And I that's what I worry about more than the political, hurly-burly of all this. I worry about what Kamala Harris is doing is she's saying it's okay to do these kinds of meager, weak settlements and call them justice. And that just defines justice down in a way that virtually ensures that there are going to be more crimes like this again, because they don't really have a cost to the offenders.
Right. I mean, $20 billion is the cost of doing business for the big banks that we're talking about. And these are, you know, this $20 billion spread out over all of the big banks, not even to an individual bank, right?
It's not $20 billion. I mean, that's the real story here,
right,
is that it's,
right,
it's phony math. Mm-hmm. It's not $20 billion. And Harris is using the kind of thing that you would say at a podium to say, yeah, we got tough on those big banks, when the reality is far different. And even if it was $20 billion, it would be a pittance, as you just said.
Right.
But the fact that it isn't even that makes it all the worse.
You write in your piece in The Intercept that there were far better things that she could have talked about in her record as California Attorney General, including the California Homeowners Bill of Rights.
Yeah. And she refers to that sort of obliquely in there, saying the toughest law in America. The California Homeowners Bill of Rights, which she did have a hand in, gave borrowers more protections against foreclosure. I've talked to local attorneys in California that say that, it hasn't been enforced very well, and it's difficult for private litigants to actually use the Homeowners Bill of Rights in an effective way. So she gets sort of partial credit for that. Harris did bring in, as an independent monitor of the settlement in California, a woman named Katie Porter, who we all know now as a member of Congress. But at the time, she was just a law professor, and she got personally involved in a lot of these cases, and she did win better outcomes for homeowners. So I do give Harris credit for that. I have a real problem with her saying that this was a triumph, that this was a success. And I wish she would be more honest about it and say, there were 50 states involved. I did the best I could for my state. And I think we need to do better. And in the future, when we have this egregious misconduct on the part of big banks, we need to get criminal penalties for the executives. We need to put these, take their bonuses. We need to have real justice, so that the people can be assured that their leaders in Congress and the executive branch are looking out for them. I wish she would say something more like that than "I took on the big banks," which just patently isn't quite true.
David, I know that aside from looking at the foreclosure crisis, you are an analyst on many general topics where politics are concerned. And I'd love to just pick your brain in this last part of our interview about how you think the presidential candidates are doing in the Democratic Party. I mean, there are a number of candidates who are mimicking people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And then you have Sanders and Warren themselves. You also have playing out a very clear divide in two wings of the Democratic Party, with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is on one side, and this new crop of progressive members of Congress, and the old guard like Nancy Pelosi. And there seems to be this battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. But everyone is so worried about Trump being reelected that it seems as though voters are constantly second-guessing themselves and trying to pick a candidate based on electability rather than whose values they actually trust. Kamala Harris's performance in the debate was seen as, well, this is the kind of thing that can take on Trump, rather than, wow, racial justice being discussed, is a great thing. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how this race is proceeding.
Well, I think you've summed it up. I mean, you do have this divide, this battle for the soul of the party, and you're seeing it play out on multiple fronts, whether it's in Congress, where Pelosi seemingly is going out of her way to disrespect and minimize the contributions of the most energetic part of her caucus, the squad, the AOC and Ayanna Pressley and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. She's seemingly just gratuitously picking fights with them at the expense of these members who are bringing so much energy to the party. And then you're seeing it on the presidential level with this divide and the old guard represented by Joe Biden, who's basically running for Barack Obama's third term, even though he's not Barack Obama, versus the Sanders-Warren wing, which are really gaining traction through policy. I mean, that's one thing that's really interesting, I think, about this presidential race, is that policy has been foregrounded, at least by Senators Warren and Sanders, and that really actually is resonating with people. But as you say, it's also cutting against this current of electability and people so frightened about Donald Trump and the specter of a second term that they're willing to take anyone who they perceive would be the best equipped to take on this president, which, is a very inexact science, to say the least. The last time we did, electability in these races, we got, Hillary Clinton as a nominee. We got Michael Dukakis as a nominee. That was on electability grounds over Jesse Jackson. We don't really know what electable means. There aren't enough presidential races to really make that consideration. And so, it's going to be fascinating to see it play out. I think the base is moving in the direction of better, more progressive policy options. What Senator Sanders did in 2016, the sort of beachhead that he carved out on Medicare for all, on student, college for all, and things around student debt. The rest of the field really is moving in that direction. Senator Warren's frame about the economy as being rigged on behalf of wealthy interests and corporate interests is the frame that everyone else is using in the race to a large degree. And so there is a sense that the progressive base is emerging within this, but a lot of time left. A lot remains to be seen on how this is going to play out. Your guess is as good as mine, actually. Who's going to come on top?
Anything can happen to knock a candidate out of the running, or at least tumble them further down the list. But if you look at the top four right now, you've got Biden on the top. The latest Washington Post ABC poll showed Biden in the lead, Bernie Sanders second, Kamala Harris third, and Elizabeth Warren fourth. Of those, as we mentioned, Sanders and Warren being the most sort of authentically progressive of the lot, the fact that they're in the top four is pretty remarkable. But then you've got the Biden and Kamala Harris. Biden is clearly the sort of Pelosi Clinton wing. Sanders and Warren are the sort of new wave, even though they're in the prime of their life, let's say. But they represent the politics of the younger generation. Where does Harris fit within these four, as far as you can tell?
I don't know, and I don't think she knows. I mean, when you look at the swings in her rhetoric and in her positions, in the debate, she raised her hand and said, you know, she would ban private insurance. And then the next morning she goes on Morning Joe and said, no, I misunderstood the question. I wouldn't do that. Obviously, the larger audience saw her on the side of a Sanders-like policy. We've seen that several times during the campaign. In the big sort of set piece of the debate around busing, when she described the hurt that she saw in having Joe Biden work with segregationist senators on anti-busing legislation. A few days later, she clarified her policy on busing, and it was no different than Joe Biden's.
Right.
So I'm not sure that she knows where she is on this divide within the party and where she straddles the line. I do think one of those four is going to be the nominee. I mean, I know we have 25 candidates or something like that, but in my view, the only four that have gained enough traction and have the ability to build a coalition that can actually win the nomination are Biden, Warren, Sanders, or Harris. And I don't think anybody else is even close. So it's going to be one of those four. And so, you know, we maybe should know what Harris's core beliefs are. Does she just want to be president, or does she have a set of core beliefs that she that animates her and motivates her in terms of her values and her policies?
David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the piece we'd been discussing earlier in The Intercept from our website. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
My guest is David Dayan. He is executive editor at The American Prospect, and his first book was titled Chain of Title. We've been discussing his latest piece in The Intercept about Kamala Harris. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.